a better way. You don't have to be another face in the crowd. Well, hi folks, this is Jack Spirko with the Survival Podcast. Welcome to an episode of Friday Flashbacks. After 15 years and hundreds of interview shows, we decided to run them as flashbacks every Friday. Beginning with the oldest of them and going forward, there's a tremendous library of wisdom in all the great interviews we've done over the years. So sit back and enjoy. Whether this is your first time or even your second time around with today's episode, I'm sure you will enjoy it and learn a lot from it. And remember, you can help support the Survival Podcast and the work we do just by becoming a member of the Survival Podcast Members Support Brigade. If you do that, you'll get access to over 70 awesome discount codes on products and services you likely already use. Things like seeds, cannabis products, food storage items, custom roasted coffee, and even cool stuff like ammo and moonshine stills and more. So support the show, get all your money back and more. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on members to learn more and sign up. Now let's get into today's Friday Flashback. And today we're flashing back to March the 24th, 2011. This was originally episode 631. This was Kelly Korn and Eric Kunzen from RootSimple.com. And I did a little... well, a little investigating for you guys when I brought this one up to rebroadcast it. And checked out RootSimple.com. They are still at it and still doing great work. And that's not always the case with interviews that are this old. A lot of folks, you know, they do a thing for a while and eventually they kind of peter out. Even if the site's still there, you can tell it's not active. These guys are still active, still making it happen. So you might want to check them out again. RootSimple.com is their website. Now let's go ahead and flash back to March 24th, 2011. All right, folks, as I said during the introduction segment, we are fortunate to have some great guests with us today. From RootSimple.com, we have Kelly Coyne and Eric Knudsen. Did I get your name there right, Eric? Did I do that right?
Jack, it's great to talk to you.
Hey, Jack.
Hey, glad to have both of you with us. As I said there, and we were talking offline, I'll leave it up to you guys as who's talking when, and you can fight about it on your end if you want to. But could you just start out with one of you anyway, telling us, you know, what is RootSimple.com? Who are you guys? How did you guys end up doing what you do today?
Well, we're married, so we are going to have to fight over the microphone here. So
you
want me to go ahead, Kelly? Go ahead. You know, we've always been interested in gardening and doing things yourself and what used to be called, I guess, for lack of a better phrase, home economics. And a couple of years ago, we started a blog.
A couple of years ago,
2006, I think, at this point.
2006.
And that became a book called The Urban Homestead. And essentially, it just chronicled our life and our interests in learning how to be self-reliant, how to do things yourself. So the book covers everything from gardening to beekeeping to all sorts of stuff. And that's how we got started. Basically just an interest in doing things and making things and making your house a locus of production rather than consumption. So you're making things in your house, and that's at its essence what we're about.
Well, you just hit on one of the big things that we talk about on the Survival Podcast, and that's converting your home from a consumer into a producer. And I think that far too many people in America today, that their home is their biggest expense. And they call it their biggest asset, but it's not really an asset. And you guys, can you talk a little bit about that little homestead of yours? How small is it, and what are you guys doing? What are you producing on it right now?
Well, the house is 900 square feet. It's a real typical little L.A. bungalow, if anyone's ever been through L.A., built in 1919. So it's pretty small, one bathroom, you know, one bedroom. It's got, we're on 1/12 of an acre.
Which is about 40 feet by 150 feet lot. So it's again, a very typical bungalow we're very close to downtown Los Angeles.
Real close here. To Dodger Stadium.
I know where you're at because I went to a game out there about 2 years ago.
Yeah, we're right around there where all those palm trees
are. And we got these outfield seats out there that we thought were so cool and because they were low cost and you could like see the guys coming out to do batting practice. And it's like the only stadium in the nation except for one other one somewhere where in a certain sections, if you sit in, you can't get to the other sections. So we were like held prisoner in the outfield. But I don't mean to digress there. It just made me think of that.
No, we don't. We're mad at them because they confiscated Eric's homebrew.
What?
Last summer, yeah.
The Dodgers took your homebrew. Did you do a blog post on that, did you?
Yeah, you know, that's a good point.
I just think the title is The Dodgers Stole My Homebrew.
You were a silent victim, Eric. How could you have done that?
Terrible.
So anyway, you've got a 12th of an acre.
Exactly. And so, you know, our philosophy is that we're very fortunate to have a bit of land. I realize a lot of people are living in an apartment. And actually, you know, we're very interested in things you can do in an apartment, too. But since we have this small bit of land, we really think that we ought to use it. So, you know, unfortunately, the biggest crop in America right now is lawns and grass. And so I think if you do have some land, it makes sense to grow some food on that land. So all the plants that we have surrounding the house are either edible, medicinal, or have some way of attracting beneficial wildlife that helps us keep the vegetables from getting eaten by bugs, essentially. So, in short, everything on the property is useful in some way or another. So there's some vegetable beds, there's medicinal herbs, there's
fruit trees,
all crammed in as tight as we possibly can. And in addition to that, we have some chickens and two beehives as well.
It makes me think of this kind of like weird uncle I had at one time, and his statement was he was buying a house and there was like no lawn, you know, it was just like in the woods. And somebody had said something to him about putting a lawn in, and he said, "My belief is if you can't eat it, sell it, or smoke it, kill it."
That's great. We always say medicinal or useful, but that's much better.
Yeah. You know.
Yeah, that's fair.
It conjures up, you know, my uncle was a little bit on the off side of the law, but the overall sentiment that we do spend a ton of money and a ton on fertilizer to make grass grow, and basically the grass is a weed, and we want one weed in exclusion to all the other weeds.
It takes a ton of water. That's our main beef with
Agreed.
Here. We don't have much water here.
Yeah, Jack, you're in a dry climate too, right?
Right. So.
I'm in Arlington, Texas, and it's pretty dry here.
Okay.
But I haven't ever watered my grass ever. And if it dies, it dies. It'll come back. And what I found is like there's certain types of like crabgrasses and clovers and things like that that have just kind of established themselves, and maybe my neighbors aren't real happy about right now because the dandelions are in bloom and they're flying around, but I don't have to do anything with my grass other than cut it, and the only reason I cut any of it is so the dogs have a place to run around, or there wouldn't be any of it left.
Yeah, I'm not really a grass Nazi, except that in particularly in our climate, it is just too dry here to be watering a lawn and not have that water go to something that you can eat. It just doesn't make sense.
If grass is kind of the default where you live, like, I don't know, maybe you live in Ireland or West Virginia or something, then, you know.
Then fine.
You know, hack it back and have a party. But I think what you're doing is great. Just, you know, if you can adapt.
And that's, I'm not trying to kill all the grass. I say that in jest sometimes. It's just that, you know, there's a place for it. The dogs do need a place to run. Kids need a place to go. But they can do that on the green stuff that grows in my yard, and it may not all be Bermuda grass. When I lived in the Northeast where we got a lot more rain, I had a lawn that was composed mostly of ryegrass and clover. And it was a beautiful lawn, but I had this landscape neighbor that used to cut it for me, and he'd say, well, I could get rid of all that clover for you. I'm like, don't you touch my clover. That clover negates my need for fertilizer. It provides nitrogen, and the rabbits eat it, and then I eat the rabbits, and everybody's happy except the rabbits, you know? And they're only unhappy when it's their turn to graduate. So, anyway, so what kind of stuff are you growing? What are like the main things that you grow on your little place?
Well, we're lucky here. You know, again, it's Los Angeles, so we have a year-round growing season. So we actually have kind of two seasons. There's a winter season and a summer season. And right now is kind of the end of the winter season. So we have a lot of greens right now. We have something called Spigarello, which is something no one's ever heard of, but it's basically a sort of like looks like kale related to broccoli.
Tastes like broccoli. It's like a leaf that tastes like broccoli.
Yeah, you eat the leaf instead of getting a very small flower out of it as you do in the broccoli. So we got that going. We have fava, which is another Middle Eastern bean. Very tasty, very large bean.
We have buckets and buckets of lettuce. We've been eating salads like 2 times a day, every day.
Yeah,
we can't eat
a little bit too much lettuce.
We can't eat our way out of our lettuce. Yeah. We got all your basic greens. It's winter in LA is really green time. It's just greens, greens, greens. And then starting about now, we start to plant the seeds for our summer crops.
I just got the tomatoes started as seedlings now. So that'll be going pretty soon. So
you guys are you doing mostly raised beds, or are you just doing in ground, or are you doing containers, everything? I mean,
kind of everything.
Yeah, a little bit of both. There is a few raised beds and a few beds that are sunken in the ground. I'm moving more towards in-ground planting.
We're saying the sunken bed is the new raised bed.
In a dry climate.
I think you're right. A lot of people, including myself, are moving more towards that. I was all about the raised beds for a while, but in the driest part of the summer, I've brought the soil up, and therefore it's more exposed to the sun, and it gets dried out more. Great in the winter because I get some warming, but not so great in the summer.
Yeah, they're also great, you know, they protect the vegetables from, like, dogs and kids and stuff, you know, anything that's running through there. I like them for that reason, too, but, you know, they do dry out, like you say. So we have two new ones that are sunk, and they're doing really well.
And the method I use is pretty much taken from John Javens, who wrote a book called How to Grow More Vegetables. There's many different ways to grow vegetables. I try not to be dogmatic about it, but that's the method I use. And it's basically known as a biointensive technique. So you're planting things really close together. You're making your own compost. You're growing your own fertilizer, as you just spoke of, with plants that bring nitrogen into the soil. So it is kind of a very, as much as is possible on a small space like this, a self-reliant method.
You're trying to make your yard into a closed loop under the Javens system, and we really like that.
And you're also getting a really tight spacing, so you can squeeze a lot of food out of a very small space.
Absolutely. And do you guys do anything with any type of livestock at all like that, like chickens or anything?
Yeah, we got four hens.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And we got our bees. That's all we got in terms of livestock.
It's a little too tight here for anything bigger than that.
Sure. Yeah. Sure, understandable. But you got four hens, so primarily for eggs, obviously, then you're not raising meat birds or anything.
Meat, too, so.
We do have friends, yeah.
And I'm open to that in the future. It's just,
We got too attached to these hens.
Right.
That was a mistake.
Don't name them.
Well, you can name them, but you name them like Stew and, you know.
I know one of ours is named Stew Pot because she's so obnoxious, you know, threatening her for years. But you know, so I know we got better hens right there doing well, and yeah, we would love to have a rooster, but you know, we're stretching our neighbor's tolerance as it is.
It's fun to stretch tolerance though, as long as you don't break it. But yeah, I know what you mean with the crowing and the, you know, things like that. So you get your chickens for, obviously they produce waste you can use for fertilizer and your eggs. And then you got bees. So how do you deal with, that's a great subject because I've noticed a lot of people I've gotten questions from, I want bees, but like my neighbor, you talk about tolerance level, you know, are going to be upset because all these stinging, flying things are flying around now.
Well, we always say bees, they're everywhere. Like, you know, it's better to have controlled bees in your neighbor's yard than crazy bees in your neighbor's roof that they're not controlling. I don't understand the logic of being afraid of contained bees.
And our neighbors behind at least know that they're there.
And love them, actually.
And like them. So it is one of those things where I do recommend people talk to the neighbors about it. And there are ways that you can prevent the bees from being a problem for your neighbors. So, for instance, our bees are surrounded on four sides by a tall fence, which forces them to fly up. So they're not going into the neighbor's yards. They're not crossing someone's path. So there are some ways to position the bees so that they're out of the way of your neighbors.
You're basically
a good neighbor.
At least on their entrance and their exit paths, you know, is what you're saying there.
Yeah, they have flight paths, and you can control those flight paths by just putting up screens. You know, it doesn't have to be anything very solid.
Gotcha.
Just put a screen or something up or stretch a tarp, and they have to bypass that. And once they're shooting high in the air, you know, they're not gonna come right back down again. So they're not gonna go right down into your neighbor's yard or back down onto your porch where you're trying to do something.
Because you bring up a valid point. I have bees all. I don't keep bees yet because my wife, very wise in her advice, says we're moving soon and you don't need any more stuff. That started about 2 years ago, and I decided she was most of the time right about that every time she said it, but I have bees all over the yard anyway. I'm looking out my window right now, and they're playing on the dandelion, so it is kind of an irrational fear. And the other thing is, I was talking to this girl one time that we were talking about all this stuff, and she was like, yeah, I don't know about bees, I'm afraid to get stung, while she's petting my 130-pound German Shepherd.
Exactly.
And I'm like, that dog, if he decided to turn on you, could take your arm off, and a bee sting is not that big a deal. Hey, I mean, I'm sure you guys have gotten stung. I've heard every keeper gets stung.
Oh, yeah.
It's part of it, but it's good for arthritis.
Oh, cool.
Let's think about it.
No, so you bring up the German Shepherds. True. We had a Doberman. He just passed on recently, and we would always laugh because people are all down on us for our dangerous activities like keeping bees, and it's like nobody says we can't keep our Doberman, you know?
You know, it's funny, the laws regarding chickens and bees are stricter than they are with dogs, and that was a funny thing about having this Doberman, who wouldn't hurt a fly, but nevertheless.
Theoretically, he could take your throat out.
Yeah, what's
you
more
know?
Dangerous, a hen or a
100-pound
Doberman?
I've never seen anybody in the hospital over a chicken. I just haven't seen it. I'm sure it's happened, like something like he flew and a guy fell off the ladder or something or what have you. But what kind of production do you get out of your bees? You got, what, one hive or two hives? And
there's two hives, and they've just been there now for a little over a year, so I didn't get anything last year. They do, at this point, I think there's probably about 60 pounds of honey in one of the hives.
Okay.
So the way, you know, actually if people are interested in keeping bees, we have a really great mentor here named Kirk Anderson. And Kirk has a website called backwardsbeekeepers.com. And it's really a unique form of beekeeping. It's all natural, no treatments, very simple kind of beekeeping. We actually get free bees. He's taught us how to rescue bees from people's walls and take them out of things like their composters and their hot tubs are in L.A. So the bees are for free, essentially. So then it's just a matter of setting up the equipment. And that's the way we keep the bees here. And I think it's a really interesting method.
I think that's awesome. I'd like you to say something on the concept of having a mentor. I've been asked a lot about this subject, and I try to not say too much about things I haven't actually done other than like a theoretical that's obviously theoretical. But one thing I've always said is when you do this, it's probably the greatest thing in the world you can do is find a local mentor. Has that really been helpful to you to have somebody locally to talk to?
Yeah, although it's tricky with beekeeping. There's a lot of people that do a highly chemical-based, old style of beekeeping that, you know, frankly, I think is the reason we have colony collapse disorder. I think you really have to seek out people like Kirk. There's a Yahoo group of organic beekeepers, which is if you're looking for a beekeeper in your area that uses these techniques, that's the way to go. Because actually, if you just walk into your beekeeping association, you're going to find what I think is a not very productive way of keeping bees. But if you go to the Yahoo group, the organic beekeepers site, you can find someone in your area who knows how to do it this way. In fact, there's a guy in Texas who keeps bees this way, who's on that site.
I think you might be right about the colony collapse stuff, because what happens with all of these things with excessive inputs, whether it's agriculture or vaccinations or anything, when you get excessive with your inputs, eventually you weaken the underlying system of resistance.
Exactly.
Yeah, there's many things, of course, in terms of nature and other complex systems like the economy, frankly, or medicine, where sometimes it's best not to do anything. So in the case of this beekeeping that we do, it's kind of based on not doing things.
We do very little.
On doing things.
Yeah. And because the bees are feral bees, they're tough. They're tough little bees.
Survival of the fittest.
It's survival of the fittest. And we let them make their own decisions for the most part, believing that bees know best. Because if once you get into contemporary science of beekeeping, you find out that bees are controlled, kind of micromanaged on a lot of levels that I think people don't understand. And, you know, if you're of our way of thinking, you start to think, well, yeah, you know, you're messing with a system that nature perfected. You know, why are you doing that?
Mother Nature is the oldest system, and it's the model, I think, for redundancy and for resilience. So, in, you know, any kind of design question we have or question about how to do things, I always think the best way is to look at the way that nature does things.
So that's a very permaculturist ethic. So are you guys into the kind of the permaculture world, or is that just like an addition to it? Or I think a lot of stuff people are doing anyway is permaculture, and permaculture is a lot of things, but have you guys kind of dug into that world at all?
Sure. I mean, a friend of ours, Larry Santoyo, is a permaculture teacher here, and I like what he says, is permaculture is just common sense. So, you know, yeah, I've read the books and interested in the ideas, but in essence, it is really just common sense. So while I don't call myself a permaculturist, I certainly use the ideas behind it.
Very cool. And you guys were mentioned too about like all the stuff that you're growing there. So you're on a very small lot, yet trees are part of what you're doing. And I get questions all the time from people, you know, I don't have enough space for trees. And I think it's about how do you do that? So what are you guys doing to make that happen?
Oh, this is something we're pretty militant about, the tiny orchard.
Exactly. So just like we grow the vegetables intensely and close together, we also grow the fruit trees close together because we don't have the space for a normal orchard here. So what we do is we actually follow, and there's another great resource out there, and it's the Dave Wilson Nursery, which is a wholesale nursery, but it has a huge website on how to do this called, I think they call it backyard orcharding. So essentially you put the trees close together, and this is the important part, you prune them so that they're more of a bush than a tree.
Yeah.
Because if you're living in a small house, you don't want a 30-foot apricot tree or a peach tree or apple tree because you're going to have 300 pounds of fruit all at once and you're not going to be able to reach it and the rats are going to get it. So what we do is we prune the trees twice a year, once in the winter to kind of do the fine pruning, and then in the summer just kind of hack it like a hedge basically so that it's small.
So they're no taller than us.
How much do you have and you know, what side of an area and what varieties? And I would imagine you're also using dwarfing or semi-dwarfing rootstock as well.
Yeah, and that's another good point is people do need to watch the, if when you buy a fruit tree, make sure that it lists the rootstock as well as the variety of the tree, because it's not only whether it's dwarf or not. Actually, the dwarf doesn't actually matter that much as long as you're pruning it small, because even a dwarf tree can get pretty big. But it does matter in terms of your soil type to watch what kind of rootstock you use. And that's where going to a knowledgeable person at a nursery can really help you in terms of picking that rootstock, because it varies depending on where you are.
But, so let's go over what kind
but
of trees
yeah, exactly. So
we have.
We're kind of being in California, we are in kind of a fruit tree. We're the land of the fruits and the nuts, right? So
it's so we've got, like Mediterranean trees. It's hard to remember them all, so let's start at the bottom of the slope and work our way back.
So we have a nectar plum.
Which is a nectarine plum hybrid, which is delicious.
Very tasty. We have a quince tree. We have a Santa Rosa plum.
And an apricot.
We have a pomegranate.
Which is fantastic.
Really nice. A fig tree. A mature avocado tree. And let's see, there's a couple more we just planted.
I just planted a whole bunch in the back. We just put five trees in our little tiny backyard.
Two persimmon trees.
Two persimmons, a peach.
An aprium.
An aprium, which is a plum apricot hybrid.
And then two apple trees.
And there's two apple trees. So that's a lot of trees.
That's a ton of trees. And most people, if you said you could do that on a half acre, they would think you're crazy. You guys are doing it on a 12th of an acre, but it's about, let's get your points that make this work again. You plant them closer together than probably anybody would tell you to. You trim them like a bush instead of a tree, and you just do it, and you make it work.
Yes. And the other thing you can do is you go to the Dave Wilson website, and they have a kind of a schedule of when the fruit comes to maturity. So if you have a small piece of land, you can plan out, okay, I'm going to have peaches at this time of year, and I'm going to have apples at this time of year, so that you can plan your mini orchard.
So you have fruit on your table
all
the time.
Or as much of the year as possible.
Right, instead of having all of your fruit all at once and you don't know what to do with it.
And do you guys bring in, you know, we talk about trimming them like a hedge, but do you bring hedges and vines and stuff like that in as well? And if so, yeah, what do you do in there? Like, you know, blackberries or blueberry or, you know, kiwi or what have you?
Yeah, vines, we love plants that just give you food and you don't have to do any work. You know, like perennials, like we have artichokes here. We're lucky to be able to grow them. A lot of food, no work. We have grapevines.
We have grapevines. We also have my favorite plant, which is prickly pear cactus, which, of course, you have in Texas, too.
Yeah, I have those everywhere. I've found them with my feet at times right through the boot. But I do love the fruit on them. It's absolutely fantastic.
The fruit and the pads in the springtime are a really nice vegetable.
Yeah, we eat the pads.
Grows without pesticides, grows without fertilizer.
Grows whether you want it to grow or not.
Makes a nice, you can make a hedge out of it, you can feed it to cattle, all kinds of things like that.
I'll tell you what else it does that's just phenomenal, but it takes, you got to have a lot of patience to wait for it to work itself out. That's if you're into mead making at all. You make a mead using a mesquite-based honey. And you mix that with the prickly pear cactus fruit. And that needs to age for about 2 years, and then the initial process of making it's about 6 months. You have 2.5 years. But it is, I can't claim credit for it. A gentleman that kind of strayed me onto the home brewing and mead making world, Charlie Papazian, who's well known in that circle, has a couple books out. It's in one of his early books, and it is knock you out amazing.
That sounds delicious.
We are coming over.
Well, once I get moved to Arkansas, you guys are welcome anytime you want. Come on up. We're in a flux now. Half our stuff's here, half's there. But you are always welcome up at the homestead. And you guys can probably help me figure out what to do with I've got about 5 acres up there. About 2 is usable. But you guys could probably go nuts on 2 acres with what you've done with a 12.
Oh, yeah. Space is a great dream of ours.
Well, move east. You can't go any further west. If there's ever a big earthquake, you might do it against your will, but...
Okay.
Well, then we're going to get really into aquaculture.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you guys, have you considered growing or have you tried growing choco yet? Which is like, they also call it something squash, but it's not really a squash.
I don't even know what that is.
You've probably seen it. You've probably bought it at markets. I can't think of the proper...
Chayote?
Chayote squash is what it's called in the markets, but it's also called choco.
Yeah, our neighbors go chayote.
Oh, it's awesome. Yeah. So you don't have to. Because when you plant those, you don't plant the seeds. You plant the whole fruit in the ground. And I was just watching a show. Are you guys familiar with Andrew Zimmerman at all?
No, we're not.
It's like squealing,
That is the fire alarm.
Okay.
I burned some beans while we were talking.
Okay, you want to go straighten that out? We'll pause a second.
I just turned off the flame. We just need to pacify the...
That's great.
Thought about the beans.
Oh, that's awesome. I'm not even editing that out. That's great. No, I was going to ask you guys, have you heard of Andrew Zimmerman in the show he does, that Bizarre Foods show? He was just in Vietnam where they grow that stuff like crazy. And he made, that wasn't him, it was Luke Nguyen is a guy. There's a cooking show called Luke's Vietnam. And he used choco leaves with wild harvested shiitake mushrooms, and he stir fried those together. And I had no idea you could eat the leaves from those, but it looked pretty good.
Oh, wow, that's the cool thing. What we've learned over time is that you can eat leaves on most things.
Yeah.
You know, all the tops of the vegetables, pea shoots, you know, you can eat so many. You know, we need to broaden our horizons in terms of what we consider edible. And there's a lot of adventures to be had there.
Like, for instance, tomato leaves, I learned last year, are used as a seasoning in the Philippines.
Really?
And they're not poisonous. Everybody thinks they're poisonous.
Yeah, they're not poisonous. Not. Maybe in large quantities, but not
poisonous. It's all about dosage.
Yeah, exactly.
And probably depending on whether you're cooking with them or not, too, to a degree. Because there was always the myth. There was a myth a long time ago that you had to cook tomatoes or they would kill you.
Exactly.
And it was the tomato itself people thought were poisonous. I just had Jason Akers on from the Self-Sufficient Gardener podcast. He was talking about the way that they actually like got over this. I can't remember the guy's name. Some guy up in the Northeast somewhere one day put out a thing that he was going to eat a basket of tomatoes in the town square. And, like, everybody showed up. This was around, like, 1800, 1804, something like that. And they showed up because they thought he was going to die. You know, they're all, like watching a hanging or something. And he ate all these tomatoes, and he walked away, and people went, huh, I guess you can grow tomatoes. So what are some other unique things? You already gave me one plant that I'd never heard of before. What are some other stuff that you're growing that maybe I wouldn't find at the Tom Thumb Market?
You know what's fun to grow is loofah. You know about that?
You mean like loofah gourd?
Like loofah gourd, like the sponges?
I've never grown those, so you guys do that?
They're easy to grow. Yeah, maybe we should grow some this year. We didn't grow them last year, but we grew them the year before. I mean, how many sponges do you need, right? But they're a vine. They're a tall, powerful vine, sort of, and they create these fruits that look somewhat like zucchini, but they're related more to the cucumber, but they're big and green. They look like zucchini, and they're pretty tough. And
they're edible. They're pretty.
They're technically in their homelands. People eat them when they're absolutely tiny, when they're really tiny, like finger sized. Because of course they have that netted structure inside them, so they're not going to be good eating for very long. We haven't tried eating them when they're little.
Okay, but when they get big, how do I turn them into a sponge? They don't probably look like that when they're out there growing, right?
No, they still look like zucchinis. You let them dry on the vine. Well, you can approach it different ways. People do it different, I think. You can let them just dry on the vine and let the vine die back. Very pretty vine. Wouldn't be ashamed to grow it up an arbor or something. It's got big yellow flowers. It's nice. But you let them die, and then you can peel them, and then there's nothing in there except for the peel and the sponge, and then a ton of seeds. Each one has a billion seeds in it. So, or you can pick them when they're fresh and sort of soak them in water and peel them. It's a little more messy. They have kind of a cucumbery juice.
That sounds like too much work. You just let them dry off on the vine, and that sounds like the way to go.
The only difference, I think, between the two methods is that when you let them dry, they go yellow or dark or almost brown. When you peel them when they're fresher and then set them aside carefully to dry, they are paler.
Okay.
I think commercially they bleach them, which we wouldn't do, but they're prettier looking if you pick them a little early, peel them, and dry them. But they work the same.
Functionality is the same either way.
Functionality is the same. Really easy to grow. Big, huge seeds. You know, you can set the kids to shaking the seeds out of them. give all the seeds to your neighbors because, you know, they're handy things to have. It's a nice biodegradable cleaning utensil.
Very cool.
Or Christmas gift.
But it's a self-sufficiency thing, too, because it's one less thing I have to purchase now. I didn't know they were that easy to process. I always knew they were pretty easy to grow, but I didn't know you just basically peeled them and then shook the seeds out. That's very cool. Anything else you guys are growing that's kind of unique?
Yeah, so generally I get all my seeds from two sources. One is Frankie Seeds, which is an Italian company. It dates to 1792, believe it or not. Still family-owned. And the La Rosa Seeds, another Italian family. They come from a place called GardenEdibles.com and also from GrowItalian.com. And I really like the Italian vegetables. They tend to have a stronger flavor and a lot of things you can't find in the supermarket. I mean, endless varieties of salad greens and greens and chicories and things like that. So
and
that,
of course they are obsessive about the tomato, the Italians.
Endless tomato varieties, all very tasty. So that's one thing. The other oddball thing that I'm thinking about lately is grain. Now, we don't really have the space for grain in our yard, but it turns out I know someone who runs a school garden, and there's some vacant lots around here, and so we're actually thinking of growing some grain this winter, because as it turns out, I've found out that Los Angeles used to grow a lot of its own grain a long time ago, and it was a grain-growing area. So that's one thing I'm thinking about. Another thing is because this is such a dry place, I'm thinking more and more about dry farming, and that is growing things with as little water or no water as possible. So I'm looking at some varieties that are native to the Southwest here.
Like native beans, corn, and squash that the Indians grew.
Exactly.
And by breeding them out in your yard generation after generation, you can create extremely drought-resistant crops, which is something we're real interested in here.
Absolutely. In fact, I was going to ask you guys, I've just come across something I'd never heard of before, and I bought some from a company called Native Seed, and they're what's called a temporary bean.
Temporary bean, yeah.
And they're designed to grow, I mean, they grow wild in basically the desert. They basically would, the Indians would, like, flood an area in the spring and plant them into that, but then they didn't touch them again, and hopefully they'd get maybe one more rain, and that was it. And they're supposed to be higher in protein. than most other types of beans.
Yeah, yeah. I think that you're not supposed to water them, right? That's how you.
No, if you overwater them, they die. They would flood the field in the spring before they planted them to get. Yeah. And I mean, you got to think about a desert field. It's not like flooding your backyard. It's it's pretty sparse to begin with. How much water it's going to retain? I think you guys really need to when you get a chance, listen to the show that came out on. It was Tuesday. Which is actually while we're talking, but not when everybody else is going to hear you. I had Paul Wheaton on, and he talked about 14 techniques for completely eliminating irrigation. I think you guys would love that. Hugel culture, terracing, you know, all different types of things, and just the way that, like, he calls it imaginary invention of irrigation. In other words, everything grew just fine until we started messing around with it.
Exactly. Yeah. Oh, you know who else is cool? Another great resource for your listeners is Brad Lancaster.
Awesome.
He's from Tucson. And
he's a writer. He's got books. Brad Lancaster. He wrote, this is for dry climates.
Rainwater Harvesting for Dryland, Volume 1 and 2. Really nice resource in terms of how you can do things just simply with a shovel, basically.
Yeah, no high tech.
To capture rainwater as it flows over your yard. So we use some of those principles. And then actually he has another program in Tucson, which is really interesting, where he harvests the mesquite pods there. And then they have a grinder and they make a flour out of them. So that's one of the things we're looking at here on a neighborhood level is doing a harvest. We have a lot of oak trees in this area.
And
carob trees, and we're looking at ways we can grind those and use those as resources. Those are street trees here.
Wow.
And there's tons and tons of
so that's food.
Absolutely, yeah. Especially the carob. There's an immense nutritional value there, and it's a little easier to process than acorn. Acorn is a great nutritional crop, but it requires a lot of work to get all the tannin leached away. But, I mean, the native peoples lived on them. It was their form of bread, basically. My experience with acorn is you can make great acorn flour, and as long as you're mixing in some other type of flour to lighten things, you get a pretty nice product. If you make, like, an acorn cake out of just acorn, it's not really good. I didn't enjoy it. Crumbly and great added to stews and soups as a thickener. Great to make like acorn pancakes out of with, you bring some flour into it, but a standalone, squirrels can have them, you know, you can do it that way. But the I didn't know carob was like growing in the streets in LA. I didn't know you guys had that there.
All over the place. We just learned that the Seventh Day Adventists planted them, which I think is pretty cool.
They took a clue from the Bible because it speaks of carob. It's a locust bean. And it's a very, like, one tree produces hundreds of pounds of pods. So it's known as, actually, sort of a survival food in the Middle East.
Like, they'll feed it to the goats mostly, but if they need it, then people eat
it. It'd be a great, is it a legume? Does it fix nitrogen like locusts?
Yes, it does.
Huh. I've never really looked at that because I don't know what the growing regions for that is. Is it like a zone 9 or?
It's a very limited growing. It's a Mediterranean plant. So it's one of those plants here that I don't think grows in a lot of places, like olive trees and things like that.
Olives, avocados.
Yeah,
you guys make me jealous with the avocados. I'm going to tell you that right now.
The avocado tree is the prize of this property.
Yeah, it would be hard to leave our avocado tree.
Yeah, that's avocados and the citrus. Those are the two things that are just very, very difficult to do at this latitude. And as I move a little further north, even more so. But you were mentioning a couple of folks writing some books. But you guys got some books of your own. Your first book was called The Urban Homestead. I think everybody's aware of the backstory there, so I won't beat it up or anything. But I asked people to go out and buy that because of that backstory with some people that think they own those two words. And you guys told me that book's now sold out, and that's why mine's backordered and I haven't gotten it yet?
Yeah, apparently it's backordered on Amazon. So,
okay.
Or it was for a while. I think it might be back.
Yeah, there's a new shipment coming in.
Yeah, they're waiting for that.
So I'd like to say thank you to everybody that when I said go out and buy a copy of that book did. And they can't tell you. Kelly and Eric can't really talk too much about this because of some legal issues, but what I'm talking about, of course, is the DeVeas family laying a trademark on a few terms, and one being urban homestead, which I think is absolutely ridiculous, and they actually sent a takedown notice to Google for their listing on Amazon for the book, which of course was denied by Google because Google is run by people that are smart. But I asked if you would like to support the work that that Kelly and Eric are doing, that you go out and buy a copy of that book. Apparently a lot of you did that, so that's just awesome, and I believe that's karma coming back around, and I'd like you to continue to make that a problem. And even if it's backorder, go ahead and order a copy. Great book. I'm still waiting for mine, but I've read enough of the reviews on it. I know it's a great book. But you guys have a new book coming out as well, right?
Oh, yeah. Indeed. Yeah, but first I just want to say thank you for doing that, Jack. And thanks to your listeners, too. We got a lot of emails and comments on our blog right after you did that. So your listeners really stepped up, and we really appreciate their efforts.
There were a lot of very kind comments, and I appreciate that.
Well, you guys are making a positive difference, and that's what my show's about. That's what the whole, I mean, there's some bifurcation, obviously, in different subsets and small groups, but I think the whole point of starting to grow your own food and taking control of your own life and going from producer to consumer is about making a positive difference in the world. And when people that are attracted to that see other people doing it and then taking the extra work and steps that people like you guys do to show people how, I think they're appreciative. So let me say thank you guys for making such a wonderful resource available.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jack. So what?
So we have a new book coming out called Making It, and it comes out in April. And it's essentially it's a follow-up to the Urban Homestead with some projects that aren't in the Urban Homestead and a few things that are maybe a little more advanced and detailed.
Well, but no, it's what's cool about Making It is that it goes from simple to complex. So there's actually a range of project difficulty that you could tackle. The way I think about it is that the Urban Homestead was sort of a why should I kind of book. It has some how-to in it for sure, but a lot of it is about kind of opening people's eyes to the possibilities of what you can do in an urban environment or a small space towards self-reliance. And one of the things we heard from some readers was like, well, we want to know more. We want more how-to. So Making It is entirely how-to. It is a pure how-to book. Project number one. Project number two.
Step by step, it's
a pure how-to.
So it's not out yet. It's coming, but give us a sneak peek. What are some of the projects that you guys have in the book? What are some of the example stuff?
It goes from everything from, like, how to make your own lip balm and face lotion, you know, which is something I'm really into, to homemade cold cures, to
beekeeping, to making beer.
There's a recipe for a pale ale, and there's in separate projects there's instructions on how to make the equipment you need to brew your own beer from scratch. So that's more complicated. So it's actually the book is arranged by time it takes you to do something. So the easy quick ones are in the front, and the big mother projects are in the back.
Very, very cool. And that's coming out in April, you said, or is it May?
At the end of
April. End of April. Well, we'll make sure that it's not even available for pre-order, then, I would imagine. If it was, I'd put a link up for you today, but
on Amazon.
It might be available. It's listed on Amazon now. I don't know if it's available for pre-order.
Well, I'll look it up then. I'll look it up, and I'll make sure there's a link in the show notes today so people can go ahead and see at least if they can pre-order it, and or at least, you know, you can get a thing on Amazon where you can say, like, notify me when this becomes available. Because I think that sounds like a great book, and if you guys like when that book is actually available, maybe you want to do the author thing and come back on, and we'll do a whole show about the book and its release.
That would be so fun, because we've really enjoyed talking to you.
Well, I've enjoyed having you guys on the air today. And again, your website, again, is rootsimple.com, correct?
Right.
Exactly.
And do you guys have, like, a Facebook or YouTube or anything like that you want to let people know about as well?
We do. I'm Homegrown Evolution on Facebook, and that might be about to change, but that's where I am if people want to friend me.
That it?
That's it.
No YouTube channel or anything?
Well, we're working on that.
We want to do that.
We're also Root Simple on Twitter if people do the Twitter thing.
Very cool. I'll follow you guys on Twitter as well. And as they say on Twitter, follow me back. But I'll put links to all that stuff out today. Kelly, Eric, I want to thank you a lot for coming on today. I learned a lot. I learned about some new plants I'd never heard of before. some new techniques I just hadn't thought of before, and we could probably do an entire show just on building mini orchards. I think that's a great thing, and I think a lot of folks here are probably going to try to emulate what you're doing there, and I imagine they can find out about all this stuff by going to rootsimple.com, and a lot more of it in your book that'll be due out at the end of the month, or the end of next month anyway.
Yep.
Well, I do appreciate it again. Thanks for coming on the air. And, folks, today this has been Jack Spirico. This time there's three of us, along with Kelly Coyne and Eric Knudsen, helping you figure out how to live that better life if times get tough, or even if they don't.
There's nothing I can do. It's the price we pay, I guess, and we follow all the rules. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.